Good afternoon, Bay Area. Welcome to the Sights and Sounds Show with Janae Darden, where every week we tap into the Bay Area art scene and bring you rich conversations with artists. On today's show, we visit the studio of an artist who paints with knives, and she's creating pieces for the Valkyries. Then a publisher celebrating 10 years of publishing translated books by authors around the world, and a woman who expresses her experience as a mom by drawing comics. Today's show is about interpretation. That's all coming up, but first a word from my KALW colleagues, Angie Coro and Johanna Miyake, on our membership drive.
KALW, and I am Johanna Miyake. Thank you for listening. I'm here with my friend Angie Coro, and we're just here hanging out, hoping that you'll call us and or visit us online at kalw.org and become a member today, because we are in the final hours of our September membership drive. You can call 800-525-9917 and join all of the other generous people that have already become members or made their donations. And I want to thank everyone who helped us make our challenge last hour. Yeah, I knew we could do it.
Balloons, cake, everybody.
I knew I didn't have to like call my mom or anything. I knew that we were going to get to that $2,500 match.
I called your mom.
You did?
Yeah.
She's pretty generous and cool, my mom. Thanks, Mom. And anyways, thank you so much for those of you. You got us there, and we're going to stay here for another couple of hours and continue asking you to give us your generous support. Call 1-800-525-9917 or go to KALW.org. Angie, will you thank some of those other folks that came through for us today?
Absolutely. It is a pleasure to say thank you to Matt Mumper from San Francisco. He says, thank you for KALW, everything you do for the Bay Area and San Francisco. You have been our daily companion for more than 35 years. You are integral to San Francisco. Our lives would not be the same without you. Matt, that is lovely. Thank you so much. Margaret Coyne from San Francisco keeps it very simple. She says, I am investing in our democracy. Thank you, Margaret. Thank you so much. You can join these folks in becoming a member of KALW, in increasing your membership, in becoming a member in the name of someone who can't. You can increase your membership monthly as well. KALW.org is key to all of this. The donate button, wow, couldn't be more in your face right there. It's pink. KALW.org. Phone number is 800-525-9917. Just because there's no match right now doesn't mean you're any less important. Make the call or the click right now.
I mean, what can be more powerful than investing in democracy, Margaret Coyne? Thank you for saying that. That really makes me feel inspired, because I think it's more important than ever to stand with KALW. There's been lots of people throughout our membership drive that have done that already, because they know how important democracy is and important the news that we bring you and the stories that we bring you are. So please pick up the phone. Call 1-800-525-9917 and or visit us at kalw.org. Become a member or make an additional donation if you're already a member, and help support KALW for many years to come. Thanks for listening. KALW.org.
Welcome back to the Sights and Sounds Show with me, Janae Darden. I've been seeing many basketball fans in the Bay Area wearing the Golden State Valkyries team color, or one of their team colors, violet. The Valkyries recently made history, becoming the only first-year expansion team ever in the WNBA to make it to the playoffs in their premier season. And of course, we had to bring art into the conversation and to the excitement. Taylor Smalls is a painter who uses knives to create large, beautiful, bold, colorful images of Black women. The Valkyries commissioned her to create a few pieces, including one for this year's Juneteenth. Taylor is an alum of the University of San Francisco. Her work also hangs in spaces of major brands like the Oprah Winfrey Network, Pixar, and Kaiser Permanente. I spoke with her at her art studio in West Oakland to learn more about the inspiration behind her work.
Hi.
Hello. How are you?
I am really good. Thank you for letting us come.
Absolutely.
Because I know some artists wouldn't do that, and that's totally cool, you know. So I wasn't sure you would say yes when I asked, because I was like, this is your creative, you know, haven, right?
So. Yeah, it is. It's not only my creative haven, but it's also my home. Right. And so I have a live-work space, yeah. And no, I really enjoy welcoming people into it so they can really see, like, where I live and work and thrive every day.
Yeah.
So I'm happy that you're here.
I mean, it's really incredible. So we're in West Oakland on a busy street. So folks, you might hear some car noise in the background. And I'm looking at these incredibly high ceiling with art, just gorgeous art going all the way up to the sky, it feels like. And it's just really amazing just to see the work that you've created. And before we even talk about your paintings, I'm just impressed with you just as interior designer.
Thank you.
So I love the vintage here. Like, we're sitting on like this old school kind of goldish, almost velvety texture sofa. Mm-hmm. You have record player. I see a cassette recorder. I just want people to get an idea of what I see.
And what we're sitting in.
And what we're sitting in. So we're like in her living area.
I believe a lot of people know this about me, but I was in architecture for 7 years. I take space and the creation of space and the curation of mm-hmm. space very seriously.
Yeah.
I studied architecture and psychology in school.
Mm-hmm.
And I really do believe that your built environment, what you wake up to, what you live in, what you spend your time in really affects your mood, what
yes.
you make, who you are, what you want to see in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And we're sitting in a space that's basically my gallery space, where I have a lot of my pieces, which feels a little gaudy sometimes. It feels a little silly okay. sometimes, but this is what I want to be surrounded by.
Right.
I want to be surrounded by, you know, very strong, and soft black women.
Yes. And I noticed these black women are different shades. So mm-hmm. they're not necessarily just brown skin. They're purple, they're greenish and goldish color,
mm-hmm.
Blue. And I thought that's really unique, because I know too, what was that painter who painted Michelle Obama? I can't remember her name. And it was
Amy Sherald.
Amy Sherald. And I remember there was controversy from the black community because
correct.
She didn't use
correct.
A brown skin.
Correct.
And so I'm seeing these really bright, vibrant colors
yes.
of these women's skin tone.
Yes.
So why did you want to take that approach when painting black women?
That's a beautiful question. Thank you for asking that, because that's actually at the core of my work and why I paint in the style that I do and why I paint with such vivid color. I'm just going to say this. Amy Sherald, legend,
yes.
like iconic, she's amazing. So many people paint black and brown skin in a dull tone. And I love color. I see black women's personality mm-hmm. very colorfully
mm-hmm.
from my upbringing, from my family, from black women who surround me currently. Mm-hmm. And I just want to basically exemplify their aura in a way where I'm actually just showing the color that I see in them.
Yeah.
And that's like, you know, exuded to me.
Okay.
And so I have always painted with bright colors and vibrant colors and joy and happiness and strength and softness all at the same time. But I love to sit with women and get to know them, because so one example is I painted Robin McBride, who owns Black Girl Magic and
mm-hmm.
the McBride sisters and all of that.
The wine.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I painted her in this like really beautiful teal color, almost like a turquoise teal.
Mm-hmm.
And when she came to the show to see the piece, she came with her daughter. They stood in front of the piece and Robin teared up, and her daughter said, I don't know how you knew this about my mom, but this is the color of our house. This is the color of our walls.
Wow.
And so I love like sitting with people, reading them, and really showing like the color that they are. Like Robin is such a boss. but she is like this like steady strength mm-hmm. and this cool presence. I, again, in contemporary art, I think that we're typically shown grayed or dulled or muddied, even though our skin is so pretty.
Yeah. It comes in so many shades.
Comes in so many yeah. shades, yes.
Yeah. We're here with your cat, and
yes,
I love
we
your
are.
Cat. Your cat just plopped on the couch, sat right between us.
Little Daisy.
It was like, I am here. But she's
so
a good cat because she's quiet.
Too. She's so quiet.
Yeah, but she sat right between us and was like, I'm getting all the love. So, you know, you talk about these images and characteristics of Black women that you paint. Mm-hmm. And so you were commissioned to paint a piece, a couple pieces for the Valkyries.
Yes.
Pronounce the was Oriflame?
Oriflame.
Oriflame. Mm-hmm. And so that was given out for Juneteenth,
yes.
right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm at a game for Juneteenth. And I'm looking at a portion of that piece. Well, tell us what you see.
This piece, actually, just a quick background on the actual original of Oriflame, is I went through a moment in my professional career where I got a lot of yeses from a lot of people and projects and decided to do it all. And I burnt out, and I saw that reflected in my work. I was using a lot of color, like mm-hmm. like almost every crayon in the crayon box yeah. kind of thing. But I realized I needed to take a breather, and I just needed to dial things back and work monochromatically.
Okay.
And so it was kind of a meditation for me to just use one color and try and make it make sense on a canvas mm-hmm. and still show and express exactly what I had been doing or wanted to be doing, but in one color way.
Yeah.
So this piece was a first for me, working monochromatically. And what I love about the serendipity of everything is that this colorway happens to be the colorway of the Valkyries.
Right.
And they are a first in a lifetime. Like this is the first for the WNBA in the Bay Area.
Yeah.
Creating this piece probably 4 years ago, I want to say, mm-hmm. they happened to want this piece.
Okay.
To be created into a Valkyrie.
That's amazing that you created this piece 4 years ago.
Yeah.
And it was in the color of the Valkyrie.
Yes.
You had no idea.
No clue.
We had an idea WNBA team was probably going to come here, but had no clue it would be that color.
Correct.
Wow.
Yeah, exactly. I think that this piece is really fitting for the Valkyries because it's an androgynous woman or person, mm-hmm. Somebody who can be taken anyway. And I think that there's so much strength in this piece, and there's so much, you almost like see resilience in yeah. it and power.
Yeah.
It was an amazing thing to work off of mm-hmm. or and work from, I guess, as a seed.
So you have the original piece that's in that lavenderish, mm-hmm. But I see like some rich purples too.
Yes.
Yeah. In the piece.
Yeah.
And the person, their head's kind of to the side, not quite giving side eye, but kind of giving this look like you don't want to mess
little,
with me.
Little cocky.
Yeah.
Little cocky.
Like, kinda like you don't want to mess with me. Kind of like, who are you?
Who are you?
Kind of like, I'm just minding my business.
Exactly. And so it's just like this, exactly. I got that.
Yeah. And they have a short afro, no jewelry or anything. Short afro. Mm-hmm. Really deep eyes.
Yeah.
And then you put over it, you said like this gold crown or helmet.
Exactly.
Okay.
So the Valkyrie crown.
Yeah.
Maybe a month or two prior to working with them, I started to really lean into gold leafing.
Okay.
And
what is gold leafing?
So gold leaf is it's like 24 karat gold. Mm-hmm. Super, super thin, I can't say paper, but it's this hyper fragile material that honestly, when you pick up a sheet of it, it might blow away in your hand, even okay. if you're in a still room.
I saw a video of you working with it too.
Yeah.
And like with your hands. Yeah.
And so I wanted to blend these two things together using this original piece that I have. Mm-hmm. So my original art piece, and then overlaying it with a Valkyrie crown. I work with Magnolia Editions always to do prints.
Okay, and Magnolia Editions, what is
Magnolia that? Editions is an institution in Oakland. They are so renowned and amazing, amazing team there, but they create incredible works on canvas.
Okay.
So if you have an image, you can print it on canvas. You can print it on, honestly, anything, on tile, on anything.
Okay.
I print with them all the time. And so I printed this digital image that I created, and then I came in over that print and laid gold leaf over the crown.
Yeah, it was beautiful how you accented that original piece with that gold crown. It turned into a completely different piece. Yeah, as I'm looking at the original without the crown,
mm-hmm.
and then I'm comparing it to it with the crown.
Yeah.
The knife palette, that was one of the things that interested me about you, is that you use knives. I can see it in the pieces. I can really see it in the originals. Like, I could tell you use some kind of knife, a spatula or something. Explain to us, what is a knife, using a knife palette? I know you don't just use artistic knives. I know you use, like, knives. I can see how, like, there's a blade involved.
Yeah.
Look at the strokes on the pieces. So talk about, I didn't even know about that. So
yeah.
Please.
Yeah, absolutely.
School me.
I will school you, because this actually comes back to school for me. I have only taken one art class in my life, and I'm, other than that one art class in high school, I'm completely self-taught. But during that time, I was asked to create 13 pieces in a semester. And I'm a really meticulous person.
Okay.
And I realized, if I have to create 13 pieces, I can't do that unless I'm just, like, basically finger painting or, like, moving really quickly and boldly. And so my professor at the time, Orlando Leyba, he introduced me to a palette knife. And he was like, you will not be able to be precise with this, but you can work large and you can work quickly. And so I picked up a palette knife, and I picked up a really thick paint.
And it's just like a flat, from what I saw, it's like a flat knife, right?
Yeah.
With a handle.
Exactly, with a handle. And it basically doesn't allow you to get nitty gritty, but big gestural movements.
And it's not sharp, right?
It's sharp.
Oh, it is sharp.
I've cut myself so many times with it, but is sharp. But then I started to realize, like, once I recognized that this was my tool of choice and was proficient in it, I started picking up different types of knives and started painting with those, because curves on, say, if you have like a certain kind of cutting knife, or like a butcher knife is like super straight, or whatever it is, like, you can kind of use anything, but it just creates this like seamless, fluid pass on pieces. And I just loved it, because you could cover so much area in zero time.
Will you do a whole painting with the knives? Or?
I will do the first layer. All of my work is about layering. I do so many layers in pieces is because I want to show skin, specifically black skin, black and brown skin, in a layered way to exemplify the person that I'm actually painting.
And you paint black women from Oakland too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which I thought when I talked to you about that, you were like, that's important to you.
Oh, it's so important.
Like, I'm looking
to
at
me.
A picture of Joyce Gordon.
Yeah.
Joyce Gordon Gallery.
Yeah.
Definitely a legend and icon in Oakland. Why are you so interested in portraying black women from Oakland?
Oh my gosh. So I went to school at USF, at the University of San Francisco, for architecture. And I kind of got priced out of San Francisco, came to Oakland, and immediately setting foot here, I just felt such an extreme sense of community here and neighborliness, I guess. and I realized that, like, the women that I was, like, encountering all wanted to, like, kind of take me under their wing. And So when I knew I was going to leave my firm, I wanted to make a point about highlighting the Black women in Oakland who I really admired.
Well, I feel seen. Thank you for making us feel seen.
Thank you. I really appreciate this, and I really appreciate your questions. They're incredibly thoughtful, and this has been really wonderful.
Thank you, Taylor.
Thank you.
That was painter Taylor Smalls. After the show, visit my Instagram page at janae.darton to see images from Taylor's art studio. The Valkyries take on the Minnesota Lynx tomorrow. Coming up, a publishing company in Oakland is celebrating 10 years of translating stories from around the world. But first, my KALW colleagues, Angie Coro and Johanna Miyake, have a few words for you about the final day of our membership drive.
Thank you, Janae. What a great show today. And Janae does an amazing job of going out and finding all the interesting and amazing creative things happening in the Bay Area for her show, Sights and Sounds. So we're here asking all of you to support that work and all of the amazing work that gets done here at KALW by becoming a member. You can do that by calling 1-800-525-9917 or going online to kalw.org. And Angie's going to thank some of those people that have already done just that.
Absolutely. Thanks to each and every one of you, and to those of you who chose not to be named on the air too. David Grossoff, San Francisco, Story Rafter from Sausalito, Jessica Campbell from Piedmont, and Judith Jaslow from San Anselmo. We're so grateful to each and every one of you. We need more people on board. It's the last day of the drive. KALW.org, click donate.
You are listening to KALW Bay Area 91.7, and this is your chance on our final day of the membership drive to call 1-800-525-9917 and become a member, or visit us at kalw.org. Thank you so much for your support and for listening.
You're listening to the Sights and Sounds show with me, Janae Darden. When I was in college, I minored in Latin American literature. I enjoyed getting lost in beautiful, complex stories that were translated to English. And there are so many stories around the world. But here in the U.S., only 3% of books published are translated. But that's not stopping the East Bay's transit books. This year, the independent nonprofit publisher is celebrating 10 years of publishing authors from around the world. And some of their books have led to major awards, including a Nobel Prize. Joining me are Adam and Ashley Nelson Levy, the founders of Transit Books. Hello, Adam and Ashley.
Hi, Janae. Thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, I'm so happy you're here. And my apologies. I said that you all were based in Oakland and you are based in Berkeley. So I just want to correct that. I'm from Oakland, so I like to claim everything.
Well, we actually started in Oakland.
Okay, there we go.
So it wasn't all wrong.
All right. I knew it was Oakland angle too. It's always Oakland angle too. congratulations on 10 years. Definitely congratulations. So I know why I like reading books in translation, but tell us why you two like reading books in translation.
Sure, I can start. So Adam and I'm from the Bay Area originally, and Adam and I met in a writing program in New York, and subsequently took jobs in legacy publishing, and we're interested in being in books. Adam was also in the translation scene there. He can speak more of that, but he translates from Hungarian. And so we had this interest in international literature, but we were noticing while kind of living and working in publishing that not a lot of international literature was coming out of the big corporate houses. Mm-hmm. We were really craving that and interested in what a list would look like and what a house would look like that really put that at the forefront, and introduced American readers to, as you say, all the amazing work from around the world that is out there and not making its way. So we quit our jobs and we moved out here to the Bay Area 10 years ago, 11 years ago, okay, and started the press here. We started small. We were working other full-time jobs on top of building it up with doing 4 to 6 titles per year. And the press, much to our pleasurable surprise started, the momentum behind it started growing very quickly. Within our first year of publishing, one of our books was longlisted for a major prize. And so we started doing a little bit more and kind of inching up that way and trying to kind of meet the moment and the momentum. And we're finding that there was a real appetite, mm-hmm. as we knew there would be for these books.
Adam, you wanna jump in?
Sure. I mean, kind of to your question about what that appeal is, or what drew us to some of the pleasures of international literature. I think this, I at least grew up reading a lot of books from all over the place and didn't really realize that they were necessarily translated. It wasn't something that I came into an awareness of until I got a little more into the publishing side of things. But I think one of the things that has always drawn me to international literature is reading perspectives from all over the world, mm-hmm. Encountering literature that can deepen your literary imagination, can deepen your political imagination, books that kind of push on the possibilities that the form of the novel, for example, can take. Mm-hmm. And it's really exciting when you encounter a book that's fresh and interesting and both really particular in an experience it describes, but also one that can reach you from across borders, from across communities, across languages, and then really touch you in that special place where you find yourself when you do encounter a really wonderful book like that.
Yeah, you know, I was introduced to magical realism, mm-hmm. by reading books from Latin America that had been translated. Like I'm thinking of like Water for Chocolate, and mm-hmm. so, and I like sci-fi and fantasy, and I had no idea that kind of genre existed. And so, you know, like you say, expand your idea of the world. Like, you know, you learn more about politics in different cultures, but also to different writing styles that mm-hmm. that other, you know, writers have, authors have in different countries. I want to go back to your time spent in New York. And so I understand you both worked in the marketing department of the New York Review of Books.
Just me. Adam was working on the agency side.
Okay, so just you. And Ashley, your novel, Immediate Family, was published by a major publisher. And so now you have a publishing company here in the Bay Area. So since you all have been immersed in, because when people think of New York, when people think of publishing, they think of New York as like the publishing capital. Why aren't there a lot of translated books published in the United States? And is it low or higher compared to other countries?
Oh, it's much lower. Mm-hmm. In European countries, for example, the percentages, you know, can easily be from 20 to 50% of the market in those countries. I mean, there are a lot of reasons why that balance goes in that direction. But here, I think, you know, there's, I think, several ways to think about it. One is that there, over the last, you know, several decades in American publishing, we've seen a lot of consolidation within corporate houses, and a lot of the you know, the transit books is of, you know, 80 years ago, joined with other publishing houses, were absorbed by larger houses, mm-hmm. which were absorbed by multinational corporations, which are beholden to, you know, their shareholders and, you know, expectations of certain profits. And what we've found, at least, is as a result, there's been a movement away from books that are a little bit more of a risk on the commercial side. Okay. And international literature often falls into that category, where you see books that are a little bit outside of what you might expect. Kind of the experience that you had encountering those books. They challenge your expectation about what a book could be. And so because they were slightly riskier bets, you would see corporate houses moving away from them. And it definitely creates an opportunity for smaller houses like ours, mm-hmm. Who can really champion those books in a meaningful way here in the US, and can connect them with readers here, which is largely the work that we've been doing since we started Transit Books.
Yeah, and I was thinking, you all took the risk and have had some really, you know, big hits, and some of your authors have won some major awards. So, and again, I just think, you know, it's just so important to, like, just read different stories from different people. I was telling you before the interview, I was on an online readers conference, writers conference during the quarantine, COVID quarantine. And it was with speculative sci-fi fantasy writers from around the world. Like, so I was up all night because it was 24 hours, you know, with people in Africa, with people in South America, people in the Philippines. And it was amazing to see the different types of horror or the different types of sci-fi that different people from different cultures produce. So it's refreshing to hear that you're taking that risk and, like, yeah, and introducing Americans to so many different types of artists, or you know, English readers.
And it's always been really important to us too, again, to put that at the forefront of our mission and the work that we publish. So from the beginning, we've always made a point to put our translators' names on the cover of our books. There's no hiding, it's a translation. So it's very clear, and to highlight and elevate the work that a translator does and what they bring to a text. And that's really important to us as well.
Yeah, because I imagine that is a lot of work. If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Transit Book founders Adam Levy and Ashley Nelson Levy. This year marks the publishing company's 10th anniversary. So name some authors that you feel we should know about. I mean, I know you love all your authors, right? It's like your favorite children. I'm all trying to save you. From any authors,
we love them all equally.
Because I know I want my publisher to say the same thing. But yeah, but tell us about some of the authors that you, you know, want us to look out for.
Yeah, of course. Well, just yesterday we published the a special hardcover collector's edition of a book by a Belgian writer, Jacqueline Hartman, called I Who Have Never Known Men. This book has lived a really kind of incredible and surprising life for us. This is a Belgian writer whose novel came out in 1995. It was translated into English right around then and fell out of print. It's a kind of cult classic of speculative literature. It's about 40 women trapped in a bunker who are then...
guarded by six men.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh. but it's just lived a kind of incredible life in that it had a nice critical reception when we republished it in 2022. But since then, it's kind of become a runaway bestseller and has sold, you know, several hundred thousand copies and really seems to be finding its moment with a new generation of readers who've called it kind of like The Handmaid's Tale for Gen Z.
It was actually fascinating because last night we were invited to sit in the beginning of a local book club that was being organized for that book. And so we kind of turned some of the questions back on the readers just to ask why this book is resonating with them. And it was just so fascinating to hear how much people are responding to the book. And
Absolutely. I can see why that definitely would be a text that would trigger a lot of conversation. Yeah. You know, so you mentioned that, you know, that you realize, especially in the success of your publishing company, that there's an interest in this. There's a need in this. Who are your readers? Like, who do you find to be your readers? Some of the characteristics of them.
What a good question.
Curious readers, I think, also poets, writers, students, educators, but also I think that audience has expanded. I don't think they're just books for book people, to be honest. I think also, I don't know, our local readership and presence, we've been hoping over the last year and a half, we're moving into our office space where we hold public events, and when we have authors in town, we just hosted one at our office last week.
Oh, nice.
Has also expanded just folks who maybe wouldn't have come across these titles and now are more interested in the books we're publishing because we're based here and they're based here, and we're trying to build out this great community of international readers here. So
nice.
Yeah. Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead, please.
No, I was just gonna say, it's kind of the interesting thing about being a publisher, because we run a publishing house, but there's so many different intermediaries between us and, you know, the people who walk into a bookstore or a library or pick up a book that's on their curriculum for the class that they've signed up for. Mm-hmm. So we don't always get to interact with our readers in that kind of way. But as Ashley was saying, one of the really kind of neat things since we moved into this new space, we were previously in Oakland and now we're in the Strawberry Creek Design Center here in Berkeley. We've been able to open our doors and kind of welcome the community in for events and conversations and think about the ways in which a publisher can be more than just, a book manufacturer right. in that kind of way, you know, acquiring a book, editing a book, printing it, getting it out into the world. We're really trying to see ourselves as a much more holistically as a literary arts organization that can be a kind of bedrock for culture in the community. So I think that for us, we're always curious about the kind of people that we are able to engage with the books or with just the around the culture of books, the books that we're publishing here. So
we also started a children's imprint in 2023 with the same through line. So it's international literature for children, translated picture books. And so we've also been able to do kind of pitch nights here in the office. Mm-hmm. Or children's booksellers in the area or librarians to let them know kind of what's coming up and books that should be on the radar. And so those were just really wonderful. Those are wonderful things we can do now, really embedding into our amazing community here that we weren't able to do as much before.
So all types of books. Are you publishing novels, children's books, nonfiction? Okay, so all types of books. I read about a Sleepless Night, your kids' book. And I understand
there's a literary fart book.
Yes, yeah. There's an epic, life changing fart that happens in the book. Yeah. We know kids love, and some adults.
So do adults. Yeah,
exactly. They love talking about farts. So when I read the premise, I thought that was funny. We have a couple more minutes, and I just want to ask you a couple quick questions. We have about 2 minutes, a little under 2 minutes. So the translators, are the translators that you hire, are they based in the U.S.? Are they global? Who are translators?
It really depends. I mean, we have a really wonderful network of translators who we know and who we trust. And I'm the kind of reader, at least, who always looks to see who's translated a novel. I'll follow translators across books that they've translated. So some of them are here. We have a handful of translators based here in the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. We also work with translators who are based all around the world, who are more embedded in the languages and literatures that they're working out of. But a lot of those, they're all kind of high literary translators at heart and lovers of literature at heart.
And we have about a minute. So 10 years.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's a party, right? There's some kind of celebration. This is a big deal.
Oh, there's gotta be.
There's absolutely a party. And the whole community is invited. So coming up in October on our children's book imprint in that line, we're publishing a book by a collaboration by Muriel Spark and the illustrator Edward Gorey. It was originally published in 1968 and then fell out of print. And we're so excited to be bringing it back into print. So we're having an Edward Gorey themed party close to Halloween on October 24th from 7 to 10 at Cellar Maker Brewery in Berkeley, very close to our office. And there's a bunch of information on our website. If folks would like to come, we'd love to see them there.
Okay. Well, definitely folks should definitely check that out. Again, congratulations on your 10th anniversary. That's a big deal. Definitely, we got to stay in touch because we read a lot here at KLW. So we definitely want to look more into Transit Books. So again, congratulations. That's Adam and Ashley Nelson Levy. They are the founders of Transit Books. And we'll have a link on our website so you can learn more about Transit Books and their authors. Next up, an artist who keeps it real and funny about motherhood and marriage. But first, I'll toss it to my KALW colleagues who have a special brief message for you about supporting our station.
You are listening to KALW 91.7. We are Bay Area wide, and we are here to thank you for your support. Especially Maria Pulitzer from San Francisco, who became a member or maybe donated, I'm not sure which, but we are grateful for it in any case. And we invite all of you listening now to call in and support us, 1-800-525-9917, or you can visit us online at kalw.org. And I will let my friend Angie say a few words to encourage you to do the same.
Indeed, I would like you to. And there's some weird adrenaline rush about waiting for the last day, the last chance, the last break to become a member of KALW or to increase your membership or however you want to do it, become more of a member of KALW. And I don't know what that adrenaline rush is about, but if it's all about you, go for it. This is the last day of our KALW membership drive. We've just taken so much pleasure in letting you know all the dynamite things that are happening here. Our new studio, our space on the wall for our donors of $500 or more, a plaque there. We have lovely gifts at KALW.org, or you can call 800-525-9917. Either way, come on board. The water's fine. We'd love to have you. And thank you.
Welcome back to the Sights and Sounds Show with me, Janae Darden. My apologies for the technical difficulties we've been having, but thank you so much for your patience. Anyway, so moving on, I've been told that motherhood is a blessing, but it definitely comes with its challenges. Motherhood is complex. I recall my late grandmother saying to me and my younger relatives when we were playfully loud or fussy, she said, "I love y'all, but y'all working my nerves." So I'm sure a lot of mothers could understand where she was coming from. Artist and graphic designer Mary Catherine Starr portrays the ups and downs of marriage and motherhood through comics on her popular Instagram page at momlife_comics. She also covers these issues in her new book, Mama Needs a Minute, a candid, funny, all-too-relatable comic memoir about surviving motherhood. Mary is having a book signing event at Mrs. Dalloway's Bookstore in Berkeley on Wednesday, September 17th, and we talked about her experience as a mom and wife. Mary Catherine Starr, welcome.
Hi, Janae. Thank you for having me.
I read your book, and I said, I got to talk to Mary Catherine.
Oh, thanks.
You know, even though I'm not married, even though I'm not a mother, I definitely felt seen when it comes to gender roles and how women are treated versus, you know, men when it comes to caretaking. So, you know, just even that, I felt seen in that regard. So let's go back to the beginning. So you went viral on your Instagram account at momlife_comics.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And what caused you to go viral was this post called An Illustrated Guide to the Double Standard of Parenting.
Yes.
And so what cracked me up was, okay, so let's just go through some of the images. So one was, dad brings home fast food and he's called Fun Dad. Mom brings home fast food and she's lazy.
Yes.
Dad pushing a stroller while texting is present. He's present, dad. Mom pushing a stroller while texting is inattentive. And my favorite, dad grocery shopping with the baby is super helpful, dad. Mom pushing the baby in the grocery cart is mom.
Yeah.
And I was like, I laughed and then I was kind of like, ooh, you know,
right.
Clearly that hit people, made an impact with people. And what motivated you to even create that post and those comics? And because you talk very openly about your relationship with your husband.
Yes. Yeah. My comics are really personal. My book, even more so. But, you know, my comics really, and the impetus, the reason I started making these comics in the first place is because of my personal experience. And, you know, my book traces this experience and kind of what got me to this point where I was making these comics. And it really comes from being a person who was in a very egalitarian, equal-minded, feminist relationship. You know, my husband and I, we started dating when I was 19 and I'm 40 now. We've been together almost, you know, my whole entire adult life. And before we had kids, things were really equal. I felt like we, you know, we did our dishes together every night. We each did our own laundry. We, you know, went grocery shopping as a team. We were just very much like a, what I felt was like a modern equal couple. And then when we had kids, wasn't overnight, but slowly over time, that equality really shifted. And I found myself doing way more of the household work, more of the childcare. Despite us both working outside the home and both working a lot of hours, I was still doing so much more. And so I was really frustrated by that. And I was really like perplexed, like kind of had this like feeling of like, how did we get here? How did this happen? And why? And so, you know, I wasn't that thoughtful about it at the time. I was more like just kind of exploring in my writing and in my creativity, which for me turned into making these comics. That wasn't what I started doing, but it turned into that. It was really just a creative outlet and a way to kind of a therapeutic outlet, a way to like process some of what I felt was the like unfairness of the way that society and societal expectations changes and really defines the roles that moms and dads have in their families, despite going into perhaps having kids being much more equal-minded. So that was, you know, really was just my own frustrations with my own situation and what I was seeing in so many of the couples and relationships around me that led me to start making these comics and in particular to start focusing on the double standards and to make this one that went viral.
So what do you think happens that causes that shift where, you know, you both are sharing household duties and then the kids come? Because, you know, all my friends, my mother's friends, my, you know, they all say when kids come into the picture, things change. Why is there a shift when the kids come? And I'm sorry, and your husband's name is Ben, right?
Ben, yes.
You know, why is it like, okay, Ben's maybe not doing the dishes as much as he used to. And I crack up at the laundry piles because the laundry piles that you draw look like mountains.
Yes.
And those baby socks.
They feel like mountains. Laundry piles feel like mountains to me. Yeah. And throughout my book, I use laundry as very much as a metaphor because I do feel like laundry is symbolic of like the like unrelenting parts of being the household manager. You know, it never stops. You're never done with the laundry. It's always coming. And usually it falls on the mom to do it and to keep it going. But, you know, I think the imbalance happens for many reasons. And, you know, part of my book was kind of trying to delve into that and trying to kind of pull back the curtain and dig through everything and go, okay, you know, why did this happen to us? What are the bigger picture reasons that this happens to us and so many other people? And I think what I learned from my comic going viral, the very first one that did, and then, you know, I had a couple since then, is that I thought this was very much like a me problem or a, you know, middle-class US-based person problem. And what I learned was that, no, this is something that women all over the world are feeling. I have women from over 40 countries reach out to say, like, it's the exact same here. And so I was really shocked by that. I just didn't expect that. You know, it made me really see that it's so much more of a universal systemic issue than it is a personal one. And so the book kind of uses our story to show the way that these systemic issues, the way that our cultural expectations can kind of get us to this place where I found myself. So, you know, I think a big part of it starts like from the beginning when you have kids, you know, the fact that something like parental leave, right? You know, that maybe dads get no parental leave or a tiny bit, or they get it, but the expectation is they won't take it. Whereas moms, hopefully more of them get it, you know, still pretty messed up in our country, the amount of leave women get, but, you know, physically women are to have to take more leave because they are, you know, maybe breastfeeding or recovering from birth. And so right off the bat, from the very beginning of parenthood, you know, moms are told by society, this is your job. You should be staying home to take care of this kid. And dads are told, eh, you're not really that important. You should be back at work. And I think that the messaging we get from there on in every way, whether it's daycares and how they communicate with parents, whether it's pediatricians or dentists, the way they communicate with parents, every message that we get is, this is mom's job, you know? So on the school forms, even if people put dad first as the contact, the mom still usually gets called from the school. I have so many examples of that kind of stuff. But I think what it all points to is that as a culture, the message we get from the time that we're young is, mom, you are in charge of the household and the children. And dad, you aren't. Your job is just to go out and make money. And so I think even though we don't believe that intellectually anymore, perhaps. Like, I know my husband and I don't believe that those are our jobs. The external pressures, the messaging we get leads us to live out this really traditional kind of hellscape, despite, you know, us knowing that's not what we want.
So what I'm hearing too is like, even though in your home, this is not what we want, this is not, you know, what we subscribe to. In your book, as you say, you're a feminist, but still you have the systems outside that stick to that traditional ideology of gender roles. Because like I said, I'm amazed because you are very open about your, you know, your issues with your husband, your struggles. And too, you call yourself out too on things too as well.
Oh, totally.
Yeah. And you rethink like, maybe I should have said this differently, done this differently. Do you, before you do a comic, do you check in with Ben, your husband, and say, hey, like, are you cool if I draw this? Like this argument we had, or like, you know, how you wouldn't bring the popcorn from upstairs. You brought two little bags of popcorn instead of the whole box of popcorn. Those little things.
I mean, yes, I've, you know, all along the way, ever since I started making these comics, I've checked with him. And he's been a really big part of the creative process. Like, he will come up with ideas.
Oh, wow.
There's one I have. It's about weaponized incompetence, which, for those who don't know what weaponized incompetence is, it's when someone is purposely bad at something to get out of doing it. Even if they're not married, you probably know what that is from your workplace, right? Can you change out the printer cartridge? I don't know how. And it's like, well, I didn't either until I learned. And now I know. And, you know, so you can learn too. Like, it's this idea that someone who's very competent at lots of things will be bizarrely incompetent at something just so they don't have to do it. So, you know, I have a comic about that. And it's all about the tools that men will use. Like, it's called, you know, weaponized incompetence, tools of the trade. And it's all these things like, you're so much better at it than I am, or it takes me longer, that kind of stuff. And my husband came up with that idea. You know, he came to me and said, I have this great idea for a comic. It's me wearing a tool belt. You know, he's telling me all these ideas of what men say. So, you know, he's definitely very aware of the stuff that I talk about in my book and in my comics. And we have a lot of conversations about it at home. And even when I made that double standards one, the very first picture in the illustration is each of us holding a bag of fast food coming in the front door, the one you mentioned. And he posed for that for me. I'm like, can you hold this paper bag? Pretend you're walking in the door. So I have a reference image. And he's like, sure. You know, and I had told him about the comic. So he's in it with me. You know, obviously I have to be sensitive and I have to check in with him.
Right.
And there's lots of conversations in our home about the content of my comics. But because it's autobiographical, you know, I feel like it's important to me to be honest and to be like a truth teller, even when it makes one or both of us look bad. And sometimes it does, you know, and I definitely get pushback from people too, saying that like, I'm in the wrong, or that I'm, you know, so it's not all, I hope it's not all like him coming across as the problem, because I think relationships are hard. And I think I try to emphasize that like I've internalized this messaging too. And some of this comes from my own self-judgment, you know, my need to have the house clean because I feel judged by it, even though I know women aren't judged by,
right.
And we shouldn't be, it doesn't define my self-worth.
Well, yeah, especially if you have, I mean, you have kids, you know, you have little small kids and kids are messy,
right.
And you're exhausted. Right. And because I know when I go over people's houses and I know they have kids and mm-hmm. and then the dog needs something too, and right. And I don't judge people because I'm like, you know, you're doing the best you can. If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with author and artist Mary Catherine Starr. Her graphic novel memoir, Mama Needs a Minute, a candid, funny, all-too-relatable comic memoir about surviving motherhood, is available now. Also, Mary is having a free book signing event at Mrs. Dalloway's bookstore in Berkeley on September 17th. I wanted to ask you, you know, comics, again, you talk about a serious issue that a lot of couples have, and you use humor because the comics are funny. I love how when you have comics of mothers maybe, you know, lecturing their husbands or getting frustrated with their husbands, and as the mothers are getting angrier in the comics, they turn into giants or like fire-breathing dragons.
Yes, it's very, very therapeutic to draw moms that way.
Yeah, I love that. I love also, too, on your Instagram and in your book, how women would send personal stories, and that actually inspires you to draw a comic based on their story. So I enjoy that too, how you incorporate, you know, those personal stories in your work. How are your comics a tool for people as far as to communicate, as far as for couples to communicate about, hey, you know, I wish you'd help a little more around the house, or I'm feeling this weight of motherhood, or just checking in with the husband, like, oh, how are you feeling as a father? So how do your followers use your comics and their relationships, at least from what you've heard?
Yeah, I mean, I think the great thing about comics is they're a really gentle entry point, you know, because you can laugh together. You can go, oh my gosh, look at this, ha ha, you know, and then do I do that? Yeah, maybe a little. I'd have a conversation that way. I also have a lot of people who will tag their partners in my comment section and be like, LOL, it's us. And it's like something that maybe isn't so flattering. But, you know, I think it's a funny way you can like laugh together, and then maybe it brings up a subject or maybe raises awareness in your household of something that has felt really out of balance that you hadn't noticed or hadn't been able to really put to words yet. So I do think because comics are less serious and they do usually have a funny aspect to them, it can just make it more accessible to like having conversations that aren't as heated about some of these topics.
I know some people listening, and again, some of your critics may say, oh, this woman is just complaining. you know, why'd you get married and have babies? You know what comes with that. Right. What's your response to that? Because, you know, women venting is a no-no in our society for a lot of people.
Yeah. I mean, I think that what you said is exactly right. People don't like to hear women, especially mothers, say anything negative about their experience. I think we're expected to just kind of shut up, put on a smile, and just get on with it. And so for me, I mean, I'm able to kind of tune out those critics because I feel like the only way we're going to really change things for future women and for future moms is by talking about this and raising awareness of it. And, you know, my book, like, it is a cautionary tale, you know, and I mean, from someone who, I really love my life. I love my husband. I love my kids. I feel so thankful for my life. And yet I feel like I don't want other women to have to kind of dig themselves back out of this hole where you feel like you're drowning. And because I think that's such a common issue now, I just think we have to keep talking about it. So I'm kind of able to say, you know, I hope, yeah, you know, certainly not all relationships have this happen to them. And I hope for everyone's sake that, you know, it becomes less and less common. But right now it's just a reality of life as a woman and a mother in many countries. And so I'm going to keep talking about it until hopefully we start to see some real change.
Well, Mary Catherine, I'm in my mid-40s and I still call my mama. So you're going to be talking about it for a long time.
I love that. That's how it should be.
The mothering does not stop.
No.
Enjoy your book signing in Berkeley. And thank you so much, Mary Catherine.
Thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Mary Catherine Starr's book is Mama Needs a Minute, a candid, funny, all too relatable comic memoir about surviving motherhood. Her Instagram page, momlife_comics, is where you can check out more of her work. And you can meet her in person during her book signing at Mrs. Dalloway's bookstore in Berkeley on Wednesday, September 17th. That's all the time we have for the Sights and Sounds show with Janae Darden. Thank you to our show producer, Porfirio Rangel, our board operator, Damian Miner, and our director of audio programming, David Boyer. And thank you for tuning in. Journalism and the arts are critical during times like these. Very, very critical. And we get to do both here on our Sights and Sounds shows. Please help us to continue to bring you uplifting and informative programs that shine the spotlight on Bay Area artists. You can go to www.kalw.org/donate or call 800-525-9917. And I want to bring in my KLW colleagues, Angie Coro and Johanna Miyake, to close out the show with me. Good evening, ladies.
Good evening.
Hello. What a treat that we get to close out Sights and Sounds.
Excellent. Yeah.
With one and only Janae Darden.
I feel honored to be with you all.
We know what it is. That is Exhibit A of why we're asking people to donate to KALW.
100%.
Absolutely. You know, multiple reasons, not least of which is this is the last day of our membership drive, but also because you just heard the kind of production that is coming out of KALW. It is local. It is entertaining. It is informative. It is immediate. And that is what you are supporting when you click KALW.org, click that donate button, and give in whatever amount you deem appropriate. Do it according to your budget. Do not think that any small donation goes unnoticed. It does not. If you're sitting there saying, I can't give enough, not true.
Yep.
800-525-9917.
I've been a member of KALW long before I came to work here, and it is something that I'm super proud of and actually really considering in these last 3 minutes that I'm going to be here with everyone. Maybe I'm going to step up and give that $500 membership donation.
Whoa.
And put my name on that wall.
Okay,
in
Johanna.
That people's studio, right?
Johanna, big bucks.
Let me call my husband and ask him if he wants to give
well,
that
bang
to
goes
me,
that one.
Give me that gift today. Are you listening, Sean? Call in 1-800-525-9917. Go to klw.org and join. Become a member, or if you're already a member, give us a little extra, like that $500, and get your name on the People's Studio that's coming to the Mid-Market neighborhood in the Warfield Commons, our new home. We've been here for over 80 years, and we want to be here for 80 more. So we're counting on
yes.
you to give. Give as generously as you can, and thank you for doing that, and thank you for listening.
Yeah. No, again, I'm so excited that you both are here with me to close out the show on the last day of our membership drive. Okay, so we got to end strong. We got to end strong, listeners, because this is the last day. And Johanna just told her husband to donate $500, which is great coming out of that last segment we just had on motherhood and marriage.
Well, and you know how competitive I am, Janae. So when we had that producer's circle match, I was like, we better make that match. So now I'm going to ask everyone in the last 2 minutes that we have, I'm going to make my own little challenge. If we can just get 5 callers and or people online to make a donation of any amount, I would be, I don't know what I would do, but I'd be super happy.
She'll dance.
Yes. She'll dance.
I put it right on YouTube.
I do that on the regular, but I will thank you from the bottom of my heart. We all will. Please make that donation. Join, be a member. Come hang out with us at 220 Montgomery because we send out a newsletter to all of our members. And you get to come and you get to have a free drink when you do that, which is also another bonus.
So, talk about the bottom line.
Right?
Free drinks.
Free drinks.
Yeah. And a lot of fun.
A lot of fun. 800-525-9917 or KALW.org. Click on donate. You're supporting everything you hear here at KALW. We know you have your favorite shows, your favorite times to tune in. Let us know. Give us your comments when you make your donation to KALW.org or on the phone line at 800-525-9917. It does not matter how much you give. It matters that you give. You all know we kind of took it with the federal funding loss, but the thing is, we've already gotten up. We've brushed ourselves off. We've gotten up. We got new plans. We got new shows. We got a new studio in line. Get us into our next life, our next happy life at KALW.org, 800-525-9917.
Yeah, we're not going to stop at KALW, so come with us. It's so easy. Just pick up the phone, 1-800-525-9917. Go to your computer or your smartphone and type in KALW.org or download that app and hit that donate button. We're counting on you so that we can be here with you for a really long time to come. Thank you so much for your generosity. It's been a pleasure being with you today. Go to KALW.org, call 1-800-525-9917. Thank you, Angie, and thank you, Janae, and everybody else in the studio and everyone at KALW for listening and being here today.